Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 030659, Austin Nursing Center, Inc., DBA Austin Nursing Center, Century Care of America, Inc., Paul Gray, Paul Hammond, and Guadalupe Zamora versus Pauline Wilson Lovato, independent executive secretary of the estate of Margarita Torres Wilson. Docket number 030790, Cynthia Lorenz, administratrix of the estate of Carolyn M. Polk, deceased, versus James M. Dunn, James F. Dunn, M.D., in United Clinics of North Texas. And docket number 031050, Alex Sheshchenoff, Management Services, L.P., versus Kenneth Jones and Strunk and Associates. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for each argument, and we expect to conclude these arguments by noon. The court will take a brief recess between each argument. The proceedings are being recorded, and the parties may contact the clerk's office for a copy of the arguments. The governor has announced a replacement for one of the vacancies on the court as of yesterday, so we expect Judge Medina to join us shortly, and we hope that the other vacancy will be filled in the near future. The court is ready to hear argument in 030659, Austin Nursing Center versus Pauline Wilson Lovato.
It is the court, Mr. Pete Baker will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners are reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, the issue in this first case is if a party acquires standing to assert a survival action after expiration of limitations, can that late acquired standing relate back to confer jurisdiction satisfy limitations?
She had standing before as an heir.
That's what the Court of Appeals held.
Why didn't she?
The Court of Appeals held that she had standing because the survival statute says personal injury actions survive to heirs, legal representatives, and estates. The Court of Appeals is the very first case and the only case in Texas that has ever construed the survival statute itself to be a standing statute.
Well, but she had standing just in a different capacity.
She had standing
under the statute itself as an heir. It's just that her capacity changed, isn't that right?
No, ma'am. It's a question of standing. The general standing rule in Texas has always been, since the 19th century, that only personal representatives have standing to assert causes of action on behalf of the state.
Well, our cases and everybody else's has sometimes used standing and capacity imprecisely, shall we say. Sometimes we say standing, sometimes we say capacity, sometimes we use both words in the same sentence talking about one thing. Isn't this technically truly capacity? Standing is a matter of you haven't been hurt by this. This is the woman's daughter. She probably alleged some hurt. Isn't it just a question of who has capacity to assert it rather than standing?
I believe that this is a question of standing and it's not a question of capacity. There is a difference, and I agree that the cases are all over the place and have used the terms interchangeably. But it is standing. Standing is a notion of who has justiciable interest, who has the right of action to assert this cause of action, and as it relates to decedent's estates, it's very important. You have this 4-year period during which administration can happen. Who has justiciable interest in that makes a big difference because there are competing interests among a number of different people. There are creditors, there are heirs, there are parties that are holding on to possession of assets, there are persons who owe debts to the estate. And what the courts have always held is that we're going to apply a rule that gives order to the system that doesn't prefer any one of those people over another.
Okay, but the relation back doctrine is an equitable doctrine.
Correct.
To me about the equities in your favor in this case.
The equities in my favor on this case are that we have a bright line statute of limitations that says you have 2 years, and in this case 75 days, to assert your cause of action and to acquire standing
and
to assert that cause of action.
And the purpose of that is so that evidence can be preserved. So I'm not talking equities. I mean, what evidence has been not preserved as a result of her filing as an heir as opposed to
I'm aware of no evidence that it's not been preserved. Limitations is a question of equity. Jurisdiction is more of a fundamental question, and you never get to the question of limitations unless you decide the issue.
So it would be fair to say you don't really have any equitable arguments. You're strictly legal.
I have an equitable argument in the sense that we were required to defend a lawsuit that was not brought by a party withstanding for 2 years and 75 days.
We said in Shepherd versus Ledford that you could qualify the widow in that case alleged in her lawsuit, the, I guess it was the wrongful death survival cause of action, that the estate did not need to be, no administration was necessary, that the debts had been paid, and there was a family group. And
yes, ma'am.
The respondent says in this case that she did the same thing, that she fit within Shepherd.
Respondent did nothing of the sort in this case. In this case, we had, after death, another heir, not respondent, filed an application to be appointed as a lawyer in this estate, alleging that administration was necessary. 9 months later, respondent files the lawsuit. Shortly after that, respondent files her own application for probate, alleging that administration is necessary. So the facts are entirely different. In that case, respondent can't come into the trial court and her action and say, wait a minute, administration is not necessary. Don't pay any attention to what I've done over there in the probate court. She filed 5 verified pleadings in the probate court, asking to be appointed administrator of the estate. The law is that the court cannot open up an administration of the estate without a finding that administration is necessary. So the family settlement agreement that was used in Shepherd only goes to the issue of whether or not administration is necessary. In this case, respondent pleaded that administration was necessary in the probate court. She asked for a finding by the probate court that administration was necessary, and in fact, the probate court held that administration was necessary.
What about our old decision in the Pope case? I know it's the early part of the 1900s. It's cited in the case that's going to be argued in behind yours, but I wondered if you had a chance to look at that and could distinguish it.
Yes, ma'am. Pope is a case where the party filed a state court cause of action and in an interstate commerce case. And the defendant said, no, this is an interstate commerce case, and therefore the FELA applies. And only personal representatives have standing in an FELA case. So she went out and got appointed, refiled as personal representative, and what the court said was there is no new cause of action. The cause of action is essentially the same, and therefore limitations is not a problem.
How is that different here?
That's different because she had standing to file her state court cause of action. In our case, Ms. Lovato did not have standing to file the survival action at any point in time during the period of limitations.
But she had limitations had run her federal claim before she filed it. She had filed a claim as the widow.
Right.
Not as the personal representative. And then she, after limitations ran, she filed a federal cause of action as the personal representative, and we held the limitations had not run.
The court didn't focus on standing in that case. What the court focused on was whether or not it was a new cause of action. And it said, no, it's the same cause of action. She pleaded the same cause of action essentially in both cases. In our case, the question is not whether or not it's a new cause of action. The question is whether or not she had jurisdiction to begin with. She had standing to assert it to begin with. In Pope, the plaintiff had standing all along. The plaintiff had standing to file her incorrect lawsuit, which she did, and she acquired standing and then had standing to file her new federal cause of action, which she did. So it's not a question in Pope of having late acquired standing relate back to confer earlier jurisdiction where it never existed. In Pope, jurisdiction and standing existed throughout. That's what the court held. That's our position.
Do you think the standing impairment in a case like this could be cured if limitations hadn't run?
Yes.
So that you could file the suit, and even though you didn't have standing, the judge wouldn't come in and dismiss it. The defendant wouldn't be entitled to dismissal. You just abated until the standing problem was fixed.
If the court heard it prior to expiration of limitations,
yes.
I don't believe that's the law, Your Honor, because standing is an element of the plaintiff's cause of action, and once the defendant calls the issue, then the plaintiff has to come in and prove standing, and therefore the court has jurisdiction. So if it's called
Subaru, looking at another kind of subject matter, jurisdiction impairment, we said that some things can be fixed, and you should try to fix those things. We said the same thing in Fodge. If it can be fixed, you should abate it and try to fix it. If it can't, then you have to dismiss the case. Does that same rule apply here, do you think?
That you can abate it and therefore get around the statute of limitations?
No, not limitations. Aside from limitations. But you wouldn't, if the defendant came in 2 weeks later and said, look, the plaintiff's not the person represented to dismiss the case, the plaintiff would have a good argument by saying, well, give me a chance to get qualified by the probate court.
Mm-hmm. I think you can do that. In fact, I think the plaintiff in this case did fix it. She did acquire standing. Her problem is she acquired it too late, and she never had standing during the period of limitations. That's her essential problem.
Of course, you cite Bell versus Morris, and yes. There the 14th Court said you can't fix standing. If you don't have standing the day you file, you're out of luck. Right?
I believe so. And there again, there's...
That doesn't make any sense at all, does it?
The principle of Bell versus Moore makes a lot of sense. The principle of Bell versus Moore is the at that time, why... tried to intervene in a lawsuit claiming royalties that her husband owned. And after, and the court said, no, you can't do that because you don't have standing. And so she acquired standing later on because in the divorce decree, she was actually awarded the right to those royalties.
So now the day we have the hearing, there's no question she's an owner. She has an interest, and we toss her out because you used to not have an interest. Even though you do now, that can't be right, is it?
In Bell versus Morris, I think there were some procedural problems in Bell versus Morris, but the principle is the same.
No, the principle I just asked you. It can't be right if somebody wasn't hurt on day one, but on day two they were hurt. They acquire the interest. Defendant wants to toss them out because you had no standing in the past. I admit you have standing now. I admit you have a colorable claim against me. But you used to not have one, so throw this case out.
Because that standing, a party with standing never brought it. That's the whole, I mean, that's what limitations is. Somebody has to assert the cause of action within the period. And bringing that cause of action requires that you actually invoke the jurisdiction.
And so, of course, since it's standing, actually, somebody that didn't have standing on day one but has it on day two, nobody says anything. We proceed to judgment. It becomes final, and 100 years later we can set it aside because, after all, standing is subject matter jurisdiction and can be set aside at any time.
Theoretically.
That's not going to be a very good way to handle this question, is it?
Except in your situation, I assume what they're doing is filing some sort of bill of review, and there are other issues.
No, they just fight the collection action when it comes up. You can collaterally attack a judgment without subject matter jurisdiction, right?
You can't collect. I believe that's correct.
So the judgments will be set aside 100 years later because we find out, unbeknownst to anybody in the whole lawsuit, the day it was filed, somebody allegedly didn't have standing.
The burden is different in that case because the burden in that case, if you raise it after judgment, is you look solely to the pleadings. And in our case, that's not what we had. We actually called the issue. We said it's part of your cause of action. You have to prove it.
But you called it a year and a half. I mean, after the suit was filed, you waited till limitations ran, then called the issue.
Yes, ma'am.
Whereas I believe in response to Justice Heck's question, if you had called it before limitations ran, she could have abated the action and avoided the limitations bar.
That's correct. And then the question becomes, who are we going to put the burden on in terms of having standing to bring your cause of action? Should we put it on the defendant or should we put it on the plaintiff who's actually bringing the cause of action? To actually acquire the standing to assert the cause of action that she's trying to assert.
Of course, if it's standing, it's on the court. We can raise that on our own, even if y'all ignore standing.
That's correct. I'm not sure if I even got on to relation back on this one. Let me ask you this.
If we looked at this as a capacity question instead, there's no question a defendant could waive capacity by not timely filing a verified objection to capacity.
That's accurate. That is accurate. And that's one of those things where we're going to call it one thing so we fit the result. And I think that's a different way of addressing it. The Court of Appeals, I think, honestly, tried to find a way to address the result. They didn't do it that way. And I don't think this court has ever done that, and I don't think this court should try to call it one thing till we get to a result. We need to actually look at what it is. And this truly is a question of justiciable interest. And who are we going to say has a justiciable interest in this cause of action during those 4 years after date of death? Are we going to say it's anybody in the world, as in the Lorenz case, where they're not even an heir? Are we going to say it can be an heir? Can it be one heir out of 16 different people?
Now, this is a Med-Mal case.
Yes, sir.
This is the woman's daughter. And why is does a person's child not have a sufficient stake in the lawsuit regarding the death of their parent?
She will when she actually receives the estate. But if during this period of time, there are competing interests. And the law says there are competing interests, and we recognize that. Because it's not just a question of heirs.
But that's when you go into bankruptcy, the trustee has the only capacity to bring suit for the reason you just described.
Yes, sir.
That's not because all the creditors hadn't been harmed. They're just as harmed before and after bankruptcy. It's because there's a different person that has the capacity to bring the charges after bankruptcy is filed.
I would argue that's standing. And I think bankruptcy is a good example. Here's another good example. Someone sets up a trust in their will, and the trust is set to terminate. There's a lifetime beneficiary. When the trust terminates, then the assets are distributed to other people. Okay? But when that person dies, are the ultimate beneficiaries, do they then have standing to assert claims on behalf of that? No. The trustee still has to administer. The trustee still has to make sure that assets go to wherever need they go to, that business needs to be wound down if there's a business in the asset, that debts need to be paid.
But let's go back to Shepherd v. Ledford about all that. It seems to me the only thing you can point to as saying that the estate required administration was that she had this medical malpractice claim. That was the only asset of the estate. It was worth more than $2,000. Am I correct?
That is apparently what happened. Again, that's part of her cause of action.
So why isn't our that means Shepherd was wrong, because that in those facts, the only asset that Mrs. Shepherd had was the survival claim, or that the estate had was the survival claim. Yet we said she's the widow, she's going to inherit, no children. The other heirs have agreed that she gets it, and this is the only asset, and she was allowed to proceed. I still have a hard time seeing how this is different from Shepherd if the only asset is the survival claim itself.
Because in Shepherd, she demonstrated that no administration was necessary.
And why hasn't that been demonstrated here? Mrs. Shepherd, what you're basically saying is if Mrs. Shepherd had then, after she filed the lawsuit, gone to probate court and been named administrator, she would have pled herself out of the lawsuit, out of the survival claim.
I think she would have. And the difference in Shepherd.
So here, if the plaintiff had not gone in and gotten administration, she would fit squarely within Shepherd. But since she got letters, she's out.
No, ma'am, because if she had, she still would have had to have proven that no administration was necessary and none was and none was pending. And remember, she's only one of 16 different heirs.
Didn't she allege in an affidavit there was an agreement among the heirs?
She alleged that there was an agreement.
And was that controversial?
It was controverted by her own sworn pleadings in probate court. That affidavit was signed within a month after she had actually obtained an order from the probate court naming her administrator and finding that administration was necessary. Remember, family settlement agreement is only evidence that no administration is necessary.
So but again, the only thing you can point to that required administration was this claim.
That's all that I'm aware of, but again, that's part of her cause of action. And that's what she said. That's what she alleged under verified pleadings to the probate court that yes, indeed, administration was necessary. I think there's one other reason that administration is necessary in this case, and that because, actually two other reasons. One, there were competing claims to be appointed administrator. Hers was not the only application for appointment. Jim Bob Wilson, I believe it was, another heir, had a previous application on file. A court needs to decide that. A probate court needs to decide that. And also, there were several heirs. There were a number of different heirs. And when there are a number of different heirs, you have competing interests as to how you handle this asset and how you divide up other assets. And the law is clear on that. We're going to look to one person. We're going to clothe one person with standing to take care of that situation.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
Please, the court. Mr. Alfonso Melendez will present an argument for the respondent.
We'd like to present four theories, alternative theories, why we believe Mrs. Lovato had standing. The first theory is because it complies with the Shepherd case. It complies with the Shepherd case, first of all, is because Mrs. Lovato is an heir. Is an heir, and it's because during her summary judgment evidence, she proved that during the period of time prior to her appointment as independent administratrix, there was an agreement pending among the heirs of how the property should be divided, and there was proof that there was no debts. It's during that period, prior to her appointment as independent administratrix, that we are able to prove that no administration was necessary. Therefore, she had standing during that period.
How can that be? I mean, she's swearing that an administration is necessary.
That's
and
right.
And she won relief on that allegation.
That's right. In order, prior, she applied for that part of the administration to be appointed as administrator about 2 months after she had filed her petition under the survivorship statute. She made that application in order to protect the property. She thought this was the best way to do it. And following case law, she thought once she was appointed, that appointment would relate back based on good current case
law. Yeah, but you're saying that as a matter of fact, when she filed the survival claim, no administration was necessary. But administration was necessary. Nothing changed between the time she filed the lawsuit and the time she filed the application for administration.
When she made that application for appointment as administration, right, she wanted to become appointed administrator based upon a family agreement. However, it's not until they filed their motion for summary judgment that there was no standing that we looked to see was, in fact, an administration necessary during that period of time.
During what period of time?
Prior to her appointment as administrator. Now, that let me explain because it's not inconsistent. The facts show that during that period of time, there was a family agreement of how the property should be distributed. Also, there were no debts. That doesn't change the facts. Those were the facts as they existed prior to her appointment. Her appointment did not occur until May of 2002.
But question is, when was an appointment of an administration necessary?
According to the probate court, that order was signed in May of 2002.
Until then, it wasn't necessary.
The fact that we had filed the petitions, we had in good faith filed the petitions, but the facts, there are still facts to show that an administration was not necessary prior to that order being signed by the court in May of 2002. And that's not inconsistent.
It's not inconsistent to go into the probate court and say, I swear to God, administration is necessary, and go down the street to the other court and say, no administration is necessary.
We don't, this is
in a summary judgment response.
The reason we don't believe it's inconsistent, because if you look at the facts, what is it that we're saying? We're saying that there are no debts, and we're saying that there is a family agreement. Based on those two facts, then we can in good faith say, well, during that period of time, no administration was
necessary. Why did administration become necessary?
We wanted to protect the property.
What property?
The lawsuit. We filed the application for administration just to protect the lawsuit.
So no facts have changed?
Well, facts certainly change. Heirs die. The original heirs that had agreed to, in the beginning, to participate in the family agreement had died, and then new heirs came into place.
Is that in the record?
No. Well, no, Your Honor. That's not in the record. And the important point, though, is this, is that the order took effect in May of 2002. If we decide to apply, as the defense would argue, apply the order back retroactively, apply the order that says that the necessity for an administration occurred prior to the date of the order, occurred prior, that is, during the pre-limitations period, then we should apply the entire order back.
What if the order binding necessity? All right, let's say she filed the lawsuit, and then subsequently her brother was named administrator. Then what happens?
You know, there was a family agreement among her and her brother.
What happens under the law? If she files a lawsuit, but then her brother is subsequently named the administrator by the probate court, what happens to the lawsuit? Has limitations run or not? Or does he relate back to the filing of the lawsuit? How does that work?
Well, if we're saying that an improper party, a party without standing, files the lawsuit, and the limitations has expired prior to the administrator being named as the proper party, then according to the defense, then limitations is passed.
No, I'm asking what's your position. If her brother had been named administrator instead of her, would you still have a valid claim?
Yes, Your Honor. The relation back doctrine. The relation back doctrine should apply in this case for two reasons. It should apply on the basis of the equitable principles of relation back.
The relation back doctrine has been codified in the Probate Code 37. Probate Code 37 says that when an administrator has been appointed...
What if someone who was not an heir had filed the lawsuit? Let's say a friend, his next friend. And then her son was appointed administrator after limitations had run. Would that preserve the claim?
Okay, there would be two theories in order to preserve the claim and two conflicting theories. For instance, in this case, we have an heir who under the survivorship statute has a justiciable interest. But if a non-heir all of a sudden is appointed as administrator, what do they rely on in order to find standing prior to the time of limitations? In my opinion, that they can rely on Probate Code 37, which is an equitable principle of relation back, which has been codified.
What if there was a will, and this was the daughter, but she had been cut out of the will. Does she have standing to bring the survival action?
She's not an heir, but if she is appointed, if there's a family agreement and she's appointed, for instance, if there's a family agreement that she be appointed or receive distribution of the estate and that she be the administrator, I don't see why not. Was that your question? In this case, there was a family agreement. The family agreed that how the money should be distributed. The family agreed that Mrs. Lovato should be appointed the administrator. This is not inconsistent with normal everyday life of how families interact when one of their parents has died. There was no debts, and there was a family agreement of what to say. Now, again, the question is that inconsistent with reality? No, it's not. Those facts were present in this case. Even though she filed an application for heirship, that doesn't change the facts that she had a family agreement and there was no debt.
I mean, families sometimes agree, sometimes they don't.
Yes, Your Honor.
So let me understand this. The deal is you got a family agreement and no debts. So you file the lawsuit. Now you've got standing. One of the family members changes their mind, claims they were under duress. A new creditor emerges and says, I have a debt. You do have a debt. You owe me. And we pay that off. So if this is standing is coming and going.
That's
right. Each of those changes.
That's right.
How can we have jurisdiction that is there one day, gone the next, and then reappears?
And that's exactly my point. If you want to apply the order appointing her as administrator, it's at the date of the order when the evidence was heard that the court made a decision that administration was necessary. It's the date of the order where the court...
Wouldn't it be easier to treat this as capacity, where if they've got an objection that she should bring this with a different hat, they have to swear to it, and otherwise they waive it?
Yes, Your Honor. If, in order to facilitate the whole purpose of the probate court, code and the court itself, they want to preserve the property for the heirs and pay the bills. That's what the whole object of administering the estate is all about. And one of the ways to do it is through, obviously, through a family agreement or through the probate court's appointment as an administrator or an executive.
But you say you have four theories, and the first one is Shepherd. And in Shepherd, you have to have no necessity for an administration, and here you have everybody in the family that ever said one way or another about it saying that there is a necessity for administration until this lady comes up to respond to summary judgment and says there's not.
Right. Mrs. Lovato, when she filed that application, she wanted to protect the estate.
But she, I know that's what she wanted to do, and I know that's what she's trying to do here. But she's swearing to a fact that she later swears is not true and then obtains relief on it. That doesn't bother you.
Well, it doesn't bother me because all of a sudden the issue that she didn't have standing is argued, and I think inequitably. The facts doesn't change that at that time she did have a family agreement. She had a family agreement of how to distribute the estate. And at that time she also there were no debt spending. Those are simply the facts that existed. The fact that she wanted to go ahead and apply for administration because she wanted to protect the state the best way she knew how, and she thought it would be related back. That's what she wanted to do, but that doesn't change the facts that there was no administration, I'm sorry, that there was no debts, and there was a family agreement. Those facts were present at the time. Now, how the court interprets those facts
to mean or what the results are. That's just what the court says. The court says that if there are no debts and if there's a family agreement, there's no necessity of administration.
What are your other three theories?
Well, the third one falls into their argument that we should apply only a portion of the court's order finding a necessity of administration. They're saying we should grab that order that was signed on in May of 2002, take that portion of the order that says administration was necessary, and retroactively apply it. But they don't want to apply the entire order. They just want to apply that portion of the order. I think that would be unfair. If you're going to apply a portion of the order that says that an administration is necessary, you need to apply the entire order retroactively back. That would be the fair thing to do. And that goes into my third theory, the third theory being the relation back doctrine. The third theory is that under the relation back doctrine, that has been codified under the Probate Court 37. Probate Court 37 says when an administrator has been appointed, they take the property as of the date of the property of the decedent's death. And the purpose of that is to, so the administrator who's already been appointed, who has done business prior to that appointment, has their acts are ratified, their transactions have been ratified in order to fulfill the purpose of the probate court.
Let me ask you about the probate order sets out percentages specifically that each heir is going to take of the estate.
Yes.
Did that match up with the family agreement, and did you put that in your summary judgment?
I don't believe it was placed in the summary judgment as far as how the distribution of the estates, because what happened is that the heirs, the reason there was a delay in obtaining an appointment is because the heirs began to die. The original heirs, they died, and not new heirs all of a sudden came into the picture. We had to try to locate these heirs, which is not an uncommon situation, and why sometimes there is a delay in obtaining a hearing on the administration of the estate because you want to notify all the heirs. But to answer your question, in the summary judgment, I believe your question was, were all the heirs who had entered into a family agreement, did they attest?
Well, you say that at the time the lawsuit was filed, there was an agreement.
Yes, ma'am.
And did you set forth what the terms of that agreement are and show that facts had changed by the time that you asked for administration of the estate?
No, Your Honor. No, what we did in response to the summary judgment is that we stated under oath, Mrs. Labaza said, that there was a family agreement that the...
But by that time, she'd already filed for administration, right?
Even prior to that time. When she filed her lawsuit, there was already...
In her affidavit in support of the in response to the motion for summary judgment, she swore that there was a family agreement and no need for administration.
Yes.
Yet she had a pending application for administration.
Yes. She did have
and
that.
And did she attempt to explain that at the time she filed the lawsuit, the facts were different?
No, there was no explanation on that, only the fact that there was a family agreement. And if we're going to strictly say that that's inconsistent and that's not, it shouldn't be applied, in other words, the fact that at the time that she filed her application for appointment, and she's also saying there's no need for administration, that's too inconsistent to use, then there was still a window of opportunity that there was no application by her for an administration. It's during that period that she had a family agreement, because when she filed her lawsuit, she had an agreement with
the trial court here saying, you're saying there's a family agreement. The other side's saying, Your Honor, that can't be true because she's filed for administration and there's a proceeding. So somebody's got to resolve that fact question. It seems to me you put the facts and all the facts in front of the trial court. Otherwise, seems like all the trial court has to go on is, well, there's administration, so there can't be, as a matter of law, unless you give me more facts, how can you say that there was no need for administration?
And I'm not trying to, she wanted the administration. There's no doubt about that. But all we're trying to do is fit the facts with the results of the law. That is, in other words, if the court says, and if the law is, that there's no need for an administration based on the family agreement and no debts, then she fits that perspective. And then she has standing, only for the purpose of standing.
Is there some reason she couldn't allege both alternatively? I mean, what if you don't know exactly whether you have debts or not?
That's right. Well, at that time, like we said, we were relying on, she wanted to do everything possible to preserve the estate, and we thought the best way possible was to...
She wanted to get the Med-Mal suit filed, right?
Right.
Her mother's deceased, so her mother can't file it. If somebody's going to file it, her or somebody else, and she was willing to do whatever needed to be said to fit our little rules about who can bring these suits and who can't, right?
That's why she filed the probate court, because she thought that would be the best way, and she thought it would apply back.
If we want her to jump through that hoop, she'll jump through that hoop. If we want her to jump through this hoop, she'll jump through that hoop.
Well, no, not for the purpose of committing a fraud in the court, no.
She just wants to get her Med-Mal case tried.
Well, yes, it's, and these were the facts as they were.
And lawyers are telling her, well, try this, well, try that. I see.
Well,
this lady didn't know anything about the probate code.
No, she relied on her lawyer.
The wrongful death claim was dismissed because of inadequate expert affidavits, expert report?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's final, is that?
Yes, Your Honor.
What's called what? Just out of curiosity, I've looked at the record. The expert reports didn't go to the survival claim, or that just was never raised?
Well, in the expert report, it never mentioned death. It just mentioned that the pressure ulcers were developed and standard of care, breach of the standard of care. But expert reports never said that the pressure ulcers were a cause of death, and then they were considered inadequate on that basis.
You had a fourth theory.
The fourth theory is based on the equitable principles of Relations Act, once again. And we're moving away from the Probate Code 37, which talks about relation backup. Now, the equitable principles say that to do justice, to prevent unfairness, and it's been argued that just because there's no subject matter jurisdiction within the statute of limitations, that this precludes the court from not applying the statute of limitations. For instance, if during the period of 2 years there was an absence of an indispensable party, and then the defendants or the defense can raise a motion to dismiss because of an indispensable party not being part of the lawsuit, and then they can apply the statute of limitations in order to have the lawsuit dismissed. Well, this court has applied equitable principles and not applied the statute of limitations even when an indispensable party was not part of the lawsuit during those 2 years. In the case of Price versus Anderson, this court applied equitable principles in order to prevent the statute of limitations from dismissing the lawsuit when during that period of time there was not a party included in the lawsuit. For instance, in the Price versus Anderson case, everybody knows that an estate cannot sue or be sued. Yet, the petition named the estate as the party. They failed to name the indispensable party, the administrator, during that period of time. After the 2 years had passed, they filed a motion to dismiss based on lack of subject matter jurisdiction, and they raised the statute of limitations to have the entire case dismissed. Because at the end of the 2 years, they went ahead and named the right party, the administrator, as the proper party. The Supreme Court decided that they were going to apply principles of equity and not apply the statute of limitations under the facts of those cases, because they found that it would be unfair, unjust to apply it, even because there was been no unfairness to the defense in that case. And those are the four theories that I believe would support standing.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Price versus Anderson, as well as almost all the other cases cited in the Lorenz case, is a pleading error case. It's a case where the defendant was sued in the name of the decedent's estate, and you're not supposed to do that. There are other cases where the plaintiff actually sues in the name of the decedent's estate, and that's a pleading error case. Our case is not fundamentally a pleading error case. Our case is a case where someone with standing never asserted that cause of action.
Can you plead in the alternative, as Judge Brister asked? I mean, could she have pled, no administration necessary, but if it is, we'll get it?
I think she could, but it still gets back to the question of whether or not she actually has standing. That's the problem in this case, is she did not have standing during the period of limitations. And if she can plead that, then she can go into the probate court and actually get a hearing that appoints her administrator. She can, even if there's not much time left, she can go into the probate court and say, I have not much time left. I need to be appointed temporary administrator. There are all kinds of procedures at play for her. None of those procedures, and certainly it's her burden to go ahead and do that. She has relief in this case.
I was under the impression that the probate pleading had to be verified. Is that not true?
Certain probate pleadings have to be verified.
Did this one have to be verified? I'm not just asking abstractly. Does the pleading of a necessity of administration have to be verified?
It does not.
Okay.
It does not. Pleadings as to determination of heirship do. Okay. And her pleading was also a pleading to determine heirship. And that brings up one of these. We have this general standing rule in decedent's estates, so we can have a bright line rule to determine who has justiciable interest in all these different fact scenarios. The fact scenarios range from we have multiple heirs and only one wants to assert it. We don't know who all the heirs are. We have competing applications for appointment. We have competing wills. We don't know which will is going to be admitted, therefore we don't know who's going to be the beneficiary.
In the abstract, yes. But we do have in this case a scenario where it could be determined that administration is not necessary.
That's right.
You just don't know.
And that's right.
So to be safe, you go ahead and get it. So really your problem is she didn't plead it in the alternative.
No, ma'am. My problem is she didn't have standing. Well, that's the problem.
The administrative order specifically found there were no debts, that she didn't own property exceeding $2,000. And it does say that there's a necessity exists for administration, but apparently we don't really know why. But we do know it specifically recites those things. I mean, isn't it possible that she had standing at the time the lawsuit was filed, but that subsequent events deprived her of standing? I mean, theoretically, she could have fit within Shepherd at the time she filed the lawsuit.
Theoretically.
And subsequent events could have taken her out of Shepherd. So standing, as Judge Brister says, comes and goes.
It can come and go. It can come and go. It certainly did not in this case. No facts changed. Absolutely no facts changed. The only thing that changed as to necessity of administration in this case was one sentence in Ms. Lovato's summary judgment affidavit that was filed a month after the probate court had already determined that administration wasn't necessary.
How do we know absolutely no facts changed?
Because we presented that to the court in our motion for summary judgment. We presented the entire probate court file.
But if it turns out 100 years from now you're wrong, somebody's going to raise it again.
If it turns out,
I mean, because you can always attack standing. There's no limitations on it. Always bring it up later.
In this case, it does not apply because the trial court found that there was no standing.
I mean, if it comes out the other way, if this case... In our companion case that came out the other way, they go, they get a judgment, somebody can attack it collaterally years from now because it turns out facts that none of us may have known about existed, which deprived her.
In theory, but they have to. It has to appear.
In theory means yes.
Yes,
correct?
It has to appear on the face of the record, Your Honor. It has to appear on the face of the record. And still the question would be, did she have standing or not at that particular time?
I haven't read the summary judgment motion. What did you put in your summary judgment motion that conclusively established at the time the lawsuit was filed she didn't have standing?
Probate court determination administration was necessary.
But that was only as of that date.
And probate applications that predated the lawsuit saying that administration verified, that said administration was necessary. And her own verified pleading that said administration was necessary without limitation as to time. There was no limitation as to time.
But, I mean, you've got to do that to be able to file your administration. So if you're going to plead in the alternative, you got to plead that in there. I mean, to go to the probate court, you've got to say administration. I don't know. I don't know if it's necessary or not. So I'm going to file here, and if I'm going to stay in district court, without an administration, I've got to say it's not necessary. I just don't know, but I'm going to plead in the alternative. Let's say she had. Then she's got to say in the probate court that it's necessary and let the court decide whether it is or not.
And then get a determination from the probate court whether or not it is. And she's got 2 years and 75 days to do that.
But, I mean, it sounds like you're arguing some sort of estoppel.
She's collaterally estopped in this lawsuit from denying that administration is not necessary. That issue was determined by the probate court at her request.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument, and the court will now take a brief recess.